Available now from Graphic Audio.
From the author of the critically acclaimed Elantris comes a beautifully crafted tale of dark intrigue, bitter rivalries, and powerful magic. In order to save his kingdom of Idris from certain annihilation, King Dedalan must honor a treaty made long ago. He must send his oldest daughter to marry Suzabron, the God King of Alondrin.
War is coming, Your Majesty. They will attack.
If we send her, Yarda, we send her to her death.
Sending Vivenna is a poor plan, but it's our only plan.
Father, if we break this treaty, it will mean war. I am prepared to sacrifice for our people.
Lord God of Colors, forgive me. Vivenna, you will not go to wed the tyrant god of our enemies. I'm sending Ciri to your place.
Ciri, the youngest daughter of King Dedalan, soon finds herself plunged into a world of intrigue and politics, inhabited by undead gods and zombie armies. And she quickly learns that there is a darkness spreading through the highest order of Alondrin, threatening to consume all she loves.
Vessel, doing your duty as the vessel was the danger.
You have to tell me something.
You must not bear him a child. That is the danger. This all, everything here in the palace, is not what it appears to be.
Cursed with a lecherous form of magic which causes her to feed off the souls of the living, Princess Vivenna battles to save the life of her sister and prevent the war engine of Alondrin from crushing her homeland.
Your father and Lemix were right. The Alondrin have everything to lose by not attacking you.
I'm not going to become an Awakener, Dim. I might turn a blind eye toward that lifeless for now, but I will not awaken.
Court of the Gods, the highest authority in all of Alondrin, Lightsong the Bold, resurrected hero of ages since past, must come to grips with his newfound immortality as he struggles to unlock the dark secret of the Pantheon of Gods and their unstoppable armies of the undead.
What do they want of me, Larimar? Do they really think I'll do it? Lightsong the Selfish? Do they really think I'd give my life for one of them?
You offer hope, Your Grace. A last, unlikely hope.
And if they're wrong, I have no desire to die. And why should it be otherwise? I mean, we have to die to heal one of them. We're gods to them only until they kill us.
And the key to halting the baying hounds of war may lie in the hands of the one man who wants to watch the world burn. Vasher, the Warbreaker.
Yeah. Are you here to free me?
No, Vahir. I'm here to kill you.
Don't miss Brandon Sanderson's high fantasy masterpiece, Warbreaker. Available now in Graphic Audio.
And now, our feature presentation.
Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Hininu's heart raced as he watched the slab fall and split, crumbling into so much worthless gravel. He dropped to his knees, eyes locked on the ruined stone. The prayer that he'd painstakingly carved on its polished surface to honor the mistress to the entrance of the valley was destroyed. All those long, long hours wasted. His brother and five other men had been fitting the slab in place above the temple entrance. It was to be the crowning piece to the structure they had all labored so hard to build.
You fools! The Mother Goddess curse you all and send your souls to a dark place for your clumsiness. Oh, curse the lot of us for coming to this escapeless hole.
He ground his fist against the earth so hard his knuckles bled, closed his eyes, and silently begged the Mother Goddess's forgiveness. He promised to carve another, more magnificent slab, one that would be placed by all of his men. There would be no risk of failure next time.
The fault is with me. The blame is all mine.
Perhaps the Mother Goddess was furious that they had spent their time erecting buildings rather than trying to get home. No, Heinenu thought. They had tried so often to rebuild the boats and sail away, and had been thwarted at each attempt. Perhaps this temple was not large enough, and in her irritation at the sight, the mistress to the entrance of the valley had caused the stone to break, displaying her displeasure. Certainly, this was not as large as her temple in Heinenu's home city. He looked at the building through narrowed eyes, seeing the sharp angles and planes and the squat, wide steps that led up to an entranceway that yawned black like the maw of a hungry beast. It was a beautiful building. Again, he stared at the broken slab and felt his chest grow tight. Stone was plentiful in this land, and so Heinenu could order more pieces cut, knock down a wall, and make the temple larger. That might appease the Mother Goddess. But his men were not as numerous as the builders he'd commanded back home. It had taken several years to accomplish this much. And what would appeasing the goddess bring them? A bigger temple would not grant the promise of a rich afterlife. This land they'd found would forever prevent them from joining the gods. This land would consign them to the abyss. Khentemsamet, his brother, hurried down the temple steps and stood in front of Heinenu, bowing respectfully and blocking the view to the entrance and the ruined slab.
Brother, the responsibility. I take it, Heinenu. My fingers ached in weakness, and I lost my hold on the prayer stone. I will accept whatever punishment you...
Heinenu rose and shook his head, looked around his younger brother to the temple entrance again. His ire had cooled somewhat, seeing Khentemsamet's penitent face and tear-filled eyes.
No punishment, brother. I will carve another slab.
The Mother Goddess.
It was merely a piece of rock, dear Khentemsamet.
But Heinenu...
The next prayer I inscribe to Hathor, our Mother Goddess, will be more eloquent. In it, I will pay better homage to she who is the wife of Horus. She is our only Mother Goddess.
Khentemsamet's shoulders relaxed, and he turned to regard the temple, his eyes avoiding the broken stone. The setting sun painted the walls a molten bronze, and the shimmering waves of heat that rose from the ground made the carved images on the building's sides appear to move. The majority of creatures, and the men and women depicted, had cow's heads or ears or horns. Hathor's was the largest. Her bovine image was enfolded in a sun-shaped disc, and her arms stretched up as if she were trying to grab her beloved Horus, the god of the sky and the noon sun. Similar figures were displayed on the handful of smaller buildings that spread away to the north, the etchings all deep, as there was little age to the structures, and the wind had not had a proper chance to weather the stone. A few of the images on the temple were incongruous to the rest. They were smaller than the carved Egyptian deities, and they formed a line like a border along the base. They were of quadrupeds with large, muscular back legs, tiny front legs, long tails, and pouches where young ones poked out their heads. Heinenu and Khentemsamet looked to the west to see a quartet of the sun-tinged animals hop across the horizon.
This escapeless hole, it will keep us from ascending.
Graphic Audio presents Rogue Angel by Alex Archer. Rogue Angel number 17, Eternal Journey. Narrated by Nanette Savard. With performances by Colleen Delaney, Terrence Aselford, Peter Stray, Joe Brack, Stephen Carpenter, Michael Glenn, Eric Messner, Tim Getman, Richard Rowan, David Coyne, Casey Platt, Nathan Bennett, M.B. Van Dorn, Tony Nam, Michael John Casey, Mort Shelby, James Lewis, Lily Beacon, Chris Rowan, and Ken Jackson.
A wide-brimmed hat the color of wet sand shielded Dr. Wesley Michael's eyes from the sun and made it difficult for the cameraman to get a good shot of his face. The man worked steadily and carefully, sifting dirt and picking out what looked like unremarkable shards of pottery, all the while oblivious to the film crew around him. Anya Creed stood back far enough so her shadow would not encroach.
Wes, look up once in a while, okay? We've been over this a few times.
The archaeologist tipped his head up and smiled, showing an even row of bright white teeth that contrasted sharply with his well-tanned skin and scruffy beard. He winked at her.
Yeah, no worries. Sometimes I don't know Christmas from Burke Street, Miss Creed. I'll get my head into this and I'll forget all else.
Wes was somewhere between 35 and 50, his hair graying, but his face unlined and his eyes bright. He was dressed in the traditional khaki pants most archaeologists wore, but his shirt was a brilliant lake blue, new and with sharp creases. He'd worn a new shirt each day of the shoot and had polished his shoes. He'd stubbornly refused to give his age and many other details about his personal life, as he was of the opinion that the site was far more important. Anya could have gotten all the biographical information she wanted for her piece from the foundation funding the dig, about Wes, his wife, and the handful of other archaeologists. But Wes was right. The site deserved the spotlight.
Don't you have enough pictures of me, Miss Creed? Thought you finished up yesterday.
Wes gave her another wink and returned to his sifting, the angle of his hat again obscuring his face. Oliver, the cameraman, peered out from behind his viewfinder.
Just about finished, Dr. Michaels. A few more pans on you. It'll be a wrap, as they say.
Thanks, Oliver. Could you get some more on the skeletons, please? That guy working over there by himself. He's uncovered quite a bit this morning. You can see the whole skull now.
More bone shots. Sure.
The archaeologists labored in a long, bowl-like depression, concentrating on a section of midden at the base of a hill, a layer of soil that was stained dark by the decomposition of refuse left behind by people who lived a long time ago. The southern section had fragments of stone tools, bits of crude jewelry, and pottery chips, the latter of which obviously fascinated Wes. Anya watched him with detached envy. It was a fascinating dig, and a part of her wished she was working it, not just hosting a television segment highlighting the site. 3.5 days of filming and interviews for a 1-hour slot on Chasing History's Monsters. She held back a laugh. There had been no monsters here, in this desolate stretch in a forest preserve northwest of Sydney. But she knew her producer would fabricate one. He'd come up with some beast that supposedly either lured the ancient Egyptians to Australia or prevented them from leaving. Some creature that had enough myths and legends swirling around it to attract viewers. Anya's attention was drawn back to the midden. Discolorations indicated spots where posts had been set for houses and hearths had been dug for cooking. Most fascinating were the unearthed stones covered with carvings. Egyptian hieroglyphs, these archaeologists were certain. Others disputed it, claiming they were merely unusual Aboriginal petroglyphs. Anya had seen plenty of petroglyphs, the paintings on rocks that usually held some religious meaning. She had to side with Wes. They certainly did look like Egyptian hieroglyphs. Wes pointed at one of the more distinct carvings that was of a slight woman with the head of a cow. One of her arms was stretched above her head. The other arm had been chopped off when the stone broke. Wes said she was Hathor, the wife of Horus, an ancient goddess, dating to dynastic times, maybe earlier. There was nothing at all aboriginal about her or Horus. Anya and her crew had agreed not to give the exact location of the dig. Wes and the Foundation had been adamant about that. They had enough problems with errant hikers trudging over out of curiosity. Too much publicity would mean they'd have to up their security to protect against looters and tourists, and that would cut into what Wes called a damn scant budget. There was a second dig about a mile away on the other side of the ridge in a lightly wooded section. It was smaller and not nearly as interesting as this, Anya thought, though certainly part of the same ancient city. University of Sydney graduate students were working there to uncover more hieroglyphs. A third Egyptian dig was taking place near Brisbane, and Anya had lobbied to visit that site too, as it was the most recent. But her producer cited timing and money, so she had grudgingly settled solely on Dr. Michaels's team. Doug Morrell, her producer, had reminded her this was all fringe archaeology anyway, because not all the experts agreed it was Egyptian. Not worth too much airtime, but certainly worth some, he had said. Normally, the hint of some monster triggered her assignment. This time, it was a leak that a rival television show was going to send a team to the dig. Doug had admitted wanting the scoop on the place. Wes Michaels hoped to get the results of some radiocarbon dating before Anya and her crew finished. Using the known half-life of carbon-14 and measuring the amount of undecayed carbon in a plant specimen his wife had uncovered at the bottom of a bowl, Wes hoped to determine the age of the features of this site. Anya knew geochronology would also help, dating artifacts by the age of the geological formation they were discovered in. But those test results were still hanging. Wes looked up at her as he wiped sweat from his forehead with his sleeve.
You know, Anya, a handful of curators are cataloging what's already been taken away from the site and storing them in a museum in Sydney. The missus and I could take you around there later this week if you'd like.
The schedule is tight this go-round, but on my return trip, I'll take you up on it.
Wes smiled and went back to work. Anya watched her cameraman work at the far end of the midden, where the archaeologist, who looked little more than a teenager, continued to brush the dirt away from a skeleton. The rest of her crew was packing up. Wes held up a curved piece of pottery on which was painted a complete image of the cow-headed woman.
Anya, I'm not an Egyptologist, but I don't need to be to tell me that that's indeed Hathor. Look, she's on several pieces here.
Anya knelt next to Wes.
The Mistress of Turquoise, she's called. Mistress of the Entrance to the Valley. Queen of the West. Lady of the Sycamore. Lady of all the gods. The gold of the gods. There were more than a few names for her. Goddess of women, music, beauty, love, joy. All the important things in this world were in her purview. They believe she blessed women with fertility. Some say the Greeks recognize her as well. Some sort of relation to Aphrodite.
Jennifer, Wes's wife, joined them. Hair tucked under a bushman's hat and nose smeared with sunscreen, she was equally difficult to pin an age to. Anya thought she was overly thin, elbows and wrist bones protruding.
She was the primal mother. Hathor was said to have some erotic significance to the Egyptian culture. Isn't that right, husband?
Say no more.
Her symbols include the sistra. It's a sort of a rattle, and we found two of them here. Hathor was especially prominent in Ta-Netjer.
The land of God, which is modern-day Dendera in northern Egypt. Her priests were male and female, dancers, musicians. Some were midwives. It was said Hathor's oracles could interpret people's dreams.
Wes passed Anya the pottery piece he'd been studying. She carefully turned it over in her hands.
Primal mother, you called her?
The Egyptians believed that the world began when the great floods retreated. And at that time, Hathor slipped from the reeds and stood on the first patch of dry ground. The first day of the ancient year was considered her birthday, and they celebrated it with a lavish festival. Before dawn, they'd tote her statue onto the roof of her temple at Dendera.
Right, so that the rays of Horus, her husband, could shine on the statue, thus representing the marriage of the sun in the sky.
Yeah, but it wasn't all light.
No. If I remember my studies, some say she was also the goddess Sekhmet, and in that guise she exacted a blood toll on mankind. A temple at Kamel-Hizim in the Middle Kingdom was dedicated to Sekhmet Hathor.
Anya handed Wes the pottery piece and mused that maybe there was a monster angle. Sekhmet down under.
In one of Tutankhamun's shrines, they discovered a carving that tells how Hathor became Sekhmet at the urging of Ra, her father. She nearly wiped out humanity, but she finally went back to being Hathor and stopped the massacre.
Wasn't Hathor said to accept the dead at the gates of the West?
Now that role wasn't dark. The goddess greeted them at the gates with bread and beer. I hope it was a pint of twoies.
I will be back, and we can all go out for a pint. Without a cameraman.
After a few moments, she drifted away to another section of the dig, leaving Wes and his wife to discuss the pottery shards and the mother goddess. Three members of the five-man film crew were leaving on a red-eye flight, but she and Oliver were scheduled to fly out the next day around noon. So tonight she'd settle back with her laptop in her hotel room in Sydney, after a good meal, of course, and search her favorite archaeology websites for more tidbits about Hathor. Maybe she'd search the fringe sites, too. She made a mental note to also look into the Brisbane dig. The theories she'd already read about the Australian sites suggested that thousands of years ago, Egyptians had sailed there looking for gold, and that the aboriginals who lived here at the time were said to have heard the beating hearts of all the ships, likely the drums that kept the oarsmen in time. Lost in thought, Anya nearly tripped over one of the archaeologists.
No room for layabouts here, hey, cover?
The lanky archaeologist raised his eyebrows when Anya caught herself from falling. His face was as smooth and flat as a shovel, and it glistened with sweat in the late afternoon sun. It wasn't a warm day, it being early fall in Australia, but his shirt was heavy and long-sleeved, and the sweat stains were dark under his arms.
No layabouts.
Your cameraman caught Josie napping yesterday, Miss Creed, and that's been sitting in my craw. I complained to Dr. Michaels about it, but I bet he didn't say anything to you now, did he?
No.
It'll make us all look like lazy louts. Not one of us is a layabout. Josie's got a touch of the flu, is all. Still under it, she is.
He wiped the back of his hand across his forehead, smearing the dirt. Anya offered the archaeologist a weak smile.
Oliver's just wrapping. We're heading back to Sydney within the hour.
He didn't need to film Josie taking a little snooze.
He gestured to the largest tree at the dig site, a 50-yard-tall stringy bark that was mostly dead. Josie, the oldest archaeologist, was sitting against the trunk.
Josie there's going to make us all look.
I wouldn't worry about it. It's a one-hour show, and we're interested in the hieroglyphics, nothing else.
Anya wouldn't go so far as to promise that the snoozing archaeologist wouldn't appear in the segment. She'd long ago learned not to make any promises regarding Chasing History's monsters.
What, 1 hour's all? Dr. Michaels will be mad as a cut snake, Miss Creed. I'll wager he figures that as many days as you've been out here, you're probably putting together some sort of series like those Alaskan crab fishermen have. Make him a local celebrity. Get him all kinds of publicity on the National Geographic Channel.
Anya feigned interest in something on the rise and headed in that direction.
1 hour's all. Excuse me.
Irritation made her grit her teeth slightly when the man couldn't see, both at the archaeologist's complaints and the shortness of the segment. This site was worthy of much more than a one-hour piece. Many of the places she visited were worthy of more. But television had its limits, she realized. She just didn't have to like them. She spied Oliver at the top of the ridge, taking a few shots of the student dig in the distance, probably going to compare its small size to the professional dig here, if there was room, she thought.
Yep. Only one bloody hour.
Anya arrived at Oliver's hotel room door after having gotten up early, mostly packed her suitcase, put on her white bikini and some pants over it and a light shirt over that, and jogged down 6 flights of stairs. The cameraman had a room on the smoking floor. Anya unconsciously wrinkled her nose.
Come on, Ollie. Answer the door. It stinks out here. Get up. Come on. I need coffee, Oliver. Come on, let's get some food. Fine. I'm going to eat by myself.
Stomach rumbling, she headed to the stairs. Anya hoped the stairs would help her wake up a bit more. She'd slept poorly, snatching only minutes here and there, with her dreams filled with fire and the notion of the mother goddess's other self nearly wiping out humankind. How would one of Hathor's oracles interpret such nightmares? She reached the lobby level and headed toward the restaurant. Anya slid into a seat at an empty table and smiled at the waiter, who quietly placed a menu in front of her. She read over the selections, her eyes widening slightly at what was on offer for the morning.
Good thing Oliver is sleeping in. I don't have to hold back ordering.
The waiter returned and looked at her expectantly. Apparently, this was one of those places that prided itself on staff who would remember everything without having to write it down.
I'll have the creamy Bircher muesli with kiwis and the strawberry and blueberry soy shake for starters. Give me a little time with that. Then I'll have the free-range eggs, three of them poached on whole wheat with tarragon hollandaise sauce, a slice of this baker's special banana and macadamia nut cake. Better make that two slices. And a side of chipolata sausage and onions. Oh, and some coffee, please.
Of course, miss.
The waiter drifted off, and the other breakfasters paid her no attention. The solitude let her think about one of the esoteric archaeology sites she'd visited via her laptop last night. Wes Michaels had told her not a single mummy had been found so far at any of the Australian digs, which was one of the factors that led some of his contemporaries to argue they were not Egyptian finds. But in ancient times, only the pharaoh and his family were so preserved. It was believed important for their journey to the afterlife, where they would join with the gods. The regular folk had no chance of ascending that high. In later centuries, however, the wealthy were also mummified, and sometime after that, it became common practice for Egyptians from all levels of society, including their cats. Based on the age of the site north of Sydney, there'd either been no relatives to a pharaoh there worth mummifying, or something had wiped all of them out in one fell swoop before a single body could be preserved.
Hathor's wrath, the monster the segment needs? Or maybe there was no natron.
Jennifer had mentioned the lack of natron yesterday, and Anya, knowing nothing about it, did a little surfing and learned that natron was a naturally occurring mix of soda ash and sodium bicarbonate, salt, and sodium sulfate. The Egyptians used it in their mummification process. No natron, no mummies. And if a body was not preserved, the Egyptians believed the soul that had inhabited it could well be consigned to a wretched afterlife. Anya shoved her finally empty plate back and put her hands on her stomach.
Wow. Ugh.
She leaned back in the chair, tipped her head up, and studied the ceiling. She wouldn't need to eat anything on the plane, or possibly the rest of the week. Anya sat straight and glanced at her watch. She'd spent more than an hour in the restaurant, and that left only 2 hours before she and Oliver had to catch the shuttle to the airport. She had time to drag him to the pool with her so he could do some laps and she could catch some sun. Anya pulled her wallet out of her jeans pocket and left some colorful Australian money on the table before heading back to the elevators. From here, Anya was going home to New York, where she would put the polish on the fringe piece, as it had been labeled. 2 days after that, she'd be on a flight to Peru for her next assignment. Maybe Oliver was up finally and would join her for a dip. If he wasn't awake, she'd roust him and drag him along. No use her being the only one with something sodden in the suitcase. Anya stepped out into the hall on Oliver's floor and tried not to sneeze from the smoke smell as she made her way down to his room.
Come on, Ollie. Ollie! Ugh.
Frustrated, Anya finally tried the doorknob. The mechanism that registered the key card had been sprung, and the door slowly opened.
Ollie?
Anya stared at the spotless, empty room. The bed was made, as if he hadn't slept in it. His suitcase appeared to be gone. She frowned. Maybe a seat had opened up, and he'd taken the red eye back with the others. He could have told her, though.
Breakfast alone, swim alone. Fine.
Anya was about to close the door when something caught her notice. She pushed the door wide and tiptoed in.
Huh.
There, at the foot of the bed, near the hem of the quilt, was a spot of something red. It looked an awful lot like blood to her. She tried to tell herself it was nothing, but the hairs on her arms prickled and indicated otherwise. She crept around Oliver's room, and this time eyed everything in a more careful light. Yes, the bed was made, but there was a crease in the middle that a good hotel maid would have smoothed flat. The chair by the lamp had been moved from its usual spot because the depressions in the carpet showed where it usually rested. The lampshade was slightly askew, too. Anya could only smell cigarettes, barely masked by floral-scented room deodorizer. She looked in the bathroom. Not a single rumpled towel, and the glasses were turned upside down on doilies, as if Ollie hadn't used them. No toiletries around the sink. No smudges on the faucet or mirror. She pushed aside the shower curtain and saw that the tub was dry. The sink basin was dry, too. Evidence to her that Ollie hadn't been in here for at least a few hours. Anya bit her lip and went to the closet. It was empty, too, save for a fluffy white robe, an ironing board propped up against the back wall, and an iron and extra feather pillow on the top shelf. Next, she checked the drawers, not sure why she was doing this, and all the while trying to tell herself that indeed Oliver had caught the red eye. Then she noticed that one of the knobs was missing from the television.
I'm operating on too wild an imagination and too little sleep. That's all.
She reached for the phone.
Hello? Has Oliver Vineland checked out? Room 312? No? Thanks.
Anya slapped the heel of her hand against her forehead.
Get a grip, Anya. Just call him.
Anya knew his cell phone number by heart and quickly punched the buttons.
Come on, Oliver. Answer.
If he was on the plane, maybe he couldn't, she thought.
Damn, voicemail. Oliver, this is Anya. Call me.
She depressed the switch hook and started dialing Doug Morrell. Halfway through, she stopped. The time difference, she thought.
To hell with the hours.
She finished the number.
Ugh. Doug, this is Anya, who hates voicemail. Has Oliver checked in with you? Call me, please.
She hung up and redialed the front desk.
Hello. Would you please contact the police? Send them up here as soon as they arrive, and send someone from hotel security now to Oliver Vineland's room. Yes, room 312. I believe something bad has happened to him.
She replaced the phone in the cradle and chewed on her lip as she considered the empty room. Had Oliver gone pub crawling? Had he come back bloodied from being on the receiving end of someone's fist? That might explain the blood spot, but it wouldn't explain his absence.
Jeez, Anya, get a grip.
He could well be in the restaurant having breakfast, and the lack of suitcase and camera equipment might mean that he left them with the concierge in preparation for checking out. Still, she felt her chest growing tight with worry and her heart racing. She was used to danger and had come to accept being shot at and kicked, but she would never get used to people around her finding trouble. The fatigue she'd felt from lack of sleep rolled off her, and again her eyes locked on the blood spot. She knelt at the foot of the bed. Leave the spot alone, she told herself. You've called the police, don't interfere. Let them... She touched the edge of the spot anyway, finding it congealed but not crusty. Maybe only an hour or two old, she guessed. Maybe Oliver had been here when she knocked the first time before going to breakfast. Maybe if she'd been persistent, then she would have found him safe.
Should have tried the door then. Ollie, what trouble did you... Police can't have gotten here this quick.
She jumped up, thoughts brightening. Maybe it was Oliver coming back to the room to make sure he hadn't left anything. Anya darted outside and nearly bumped into a long-nosed man with a hotel security badge on his dark blue suit coat.
Oh, sorry, I...
You're the one who...
Called the front desk? Yes, I...
Reported trouble with one of our guests. A Mr. Oliver Vineland from the United States.
Oliver Vineland, yes. My cameraman. He's gone missing. I found a spot of blood. It's at the foot of the bed.
Anya stood there only a moment more, looking between the open hotel room door and the security man, and then she stepped around him and to the elevator and thumbed the up button.
Miss,
Creed, Anya Creed, room 914. I'll be right back. I have to get my cell phone. Maybe he left a message?
Anya slipped into the elevator, pressed the button for the 9th floor, and shifted back and forth on the balls of her feet. The airport? Maybe she should call American just to make sure that he hadn't caught the red-eye flight to LaGuardia. One final time, she told herself that all this worry was for nothing and that she was wasting the hotel security man's time and soon the police's time. She prayed she was wasting everyone's time and that Oliver was all right. But he wasn't all right, she confirmed when the elevator doors opened onto her floor and she stepped out. Someone was ransacking her room. Anya reached for the sword of Joan of Arc now, touching the pommel where it resided in the otherwhere. But she stopped short of drawing the sword. She had to assess the situation first. She sprinted down the hall to the doorway of her room. Inside were three dark-skinned, dark-clad men. The tallest one looked up from where he was standing on her shattered laptop.
That's the woman! That's the one who was with the photographer! Kill her!
Anya drew the sword as the barrel-chested man closest to her fumbled at his back for a gun. Anya struck him hard in the side of the head with the flat of the blade. Dazed, he shook his head but continued to go for the gun. Anya jabbed the heel of one hand into his throat. Anya turned her attention to the other two men. One, the smallest, had dropped a pair of her shoes and gaped at her when she'd entered. The tallest, the one who had stomped on her laptop, was near the desk.
Kill her! Kill her!
Are those the only words you know?
The barrel-chested man finally caught his breath, bolted upright, and grabbed her arm.
She's got a sword!
The tall one pulled a gun from his waistband.
I think we can all see that, Suka!
What should I do, Sute?
Surrender, all of you!
Kill her, I said!
Zuka, the barrel-chested man, pulled her toward him. Using his momentum, she slammed herself against him, pinning him to the wall. Her shirt ripped right off, still clutched in his thick fingers. Anya drove her heel down on his instep and jabbed her right elbow into his gut. Then she slung him around just as the tall man fired. The bullet struck Zuka. Anya jumped back, bumping into the doorframe. The second shot grazed Anya's shoulder. Ignoring the pain, she brought the sword around until it was aimed at the tall man's heart. His gun jammed. He threw it at her. She sidestepped it easily.
Thrice, damn you!
Anya adjusted the grip on her sword.
You will join Zuka, Anya Creek. Join him in hell, as my master commands!
In a flash, the man reached behind his back again, retrieving a second gun. Anya hit the barrel with her sword and knocked the gun away.
A pit for you, Anya Creed!
Why? What did I do to you? And who was your master?
The tall man backed away and drew a dagger. The wiry one had a gun too, but it wasn't aimed at her. He was looking beyond Anya and to the doorway behind her, his hands shaking.
Sute! There are people in the hall!
Oh, I hear siren.
Blouse got a gun, and the shader's got a sword.
Get out of here! They have guns!
The frightened, wiry man finally pointed his gun at Anya. Anya spun like a top and darted close to the man called Sute, plunging her sword into his stomach. His eyes bulged as the dagger slipped from his hand, and he toppled over, dead. Anya pulled her sword free. The wiry man vaulted past her and across the bed. He fired his gun wildly into the crowd gathered in the hallway. The wiry man took advantage of the panic and rushed into the hallway, away from the panicked people, and waving his gun to keep anyone from following him. Anya leaped over the wounded man and ran into the hall. She saw a police officer step out of the elevator and wedge his way through the panicked hotel guests. In that instant, she willed the sword away. Her target darted around the corner of an intersecting hallway and pushed open the door to the stairwell. Anya ran after him. She turned the corner and thrust the heel of her hand against the door. Anya ran after the fleeing man, taking three steps at a time. One landing later, she caught sight of him. Leaning against the railing, he fired upward, the bullets ricocheting harmlessly off the bottoms of the steps above him. Then he vaulted over the railing, dropped to the next lower level, and she did the same, only a few dozen steps behind him now. Anya was just beyond the landing for the 5th floor when the door slammed open directly behind her. Police was her first thought, but three silenced bullets whizzing past her head ended that notion. She dropped to a crouch. two guns, she realized, as she spun to face the new adversaries. Two men burst onto the fifth floor landing. They were also dressed in black, but they looked a little different, with broad shoulders and thick arms like bodybuilders or professional muscle. Anya somersaulted down to the fourth floor landing, then rounded the stairwell and headed for the third floor. The wiry man stood down there, blocking her way and holding his gun out, both hands clamped so tight his knuckles looked pale. His fingers trembled and sweat beaded heavily on his face.
Stop!
Anya flattened herself against the outer stairwell wall. She willed the sword to her, holding it tight as she dove off the step. She tucked herself into a ball and somersaulted, aiming her feet at the wiry man's face. Then several bullets struck the wiry man. Anya continued down the next flight of stairs.
Stop! Stop running! This is the police!
Halfway down to the first floor, Anya stopped and whirled. A body tumbled down the stairs. Only one dark-clad man appeared on the steps above her, holding a Glock 17. She feinted to her right, then dipped and pivoted to her left. He fired at where she'd stood a breath before. She flew up at him, executing a hammering block when his leg came out to defend himself.
What is this about? What have you done with Oliver?
He tried to draw a bead on her, shooting the metal railing instead. Only one step below him now, she grabbed his raised leg and tugged. He swept the gun at her, the barrel striking her face. He brought it back for a second strike. One hand wrapped around the hilt of her sword, Anya opened her other hand and redirected his next blow. He hadn't anticipated that, and scrambled to maintain his hold on the gun. She rammed the heel of her hand into his stomach.
I don't want to have to kill you.
There's one more shooter down there. Call it in at 110.
Anya desperately wanted to sort all this out before letting the authorities question her for hours. She brought her sword around in a swiping cut. The blade sheared into the man's fingers, forcing him to release the gun.
Same to you!
The man lashed out with one leg, and then the other, clipping Anya once, but causing her no real harm.
I said I don't want to kill you. Know any English?
The police nearing, she again dismissed the sword, in the same motion reaching up and grabbing her attacker's shirt. She lifted him and spun him so he was on the step below her now. Then she pushed him and rode him down the rest of the steps like a bobsled, the back of his head cracking hard and making her wince. For a moment, Anya feared she might have indeed killed him, but he feebly tried to knock her off him. She jammed her knee into his stomach.
Where is Oliver? What have you done with him? So what? What did we see?
I seen him. The woman and a man. The man won't be dead.
He's not dead yet.
Anya pushed herself off him and jumped down the last few steps and out the exit door. A heartbeat later, she was in the lobby. She walked quickly as she dared without drawing attention to herself. Then she was through the revolving doors and onto the sidewalk, sucking in the cool fall air. She couldn't get any more out of her attacker until he came to, and that would be under police guard in a local hospital. The police would take her in, too, as they would no doubt connect her to the reports of a woman in jeans and a bikini top swinging a sword. But it would take time. Maybe the police would let her call her producer first, or try Oliver again. Not likely. But necessary. Anya started to run. She had to tell Doug about the attack and ask him to check on the rest of the crew. What had she and Ollie seen? Leaving the scene of a crime wasn't a good thing, she knew, but she needed space. Anya spied a payphone on the street corner. She hoped she had enough coins to make it work.
Pardon me, miss, but are you hurt? You're bleeding and...
Anya just shook her head and kept moving.
Oi, police! Over here, mate! This woman's hurt! Oi!
Anya didn't need to look back to know that at least one officer had come out of the hotel in search of her or anyone else involved in the mayhem. Her hand closed on the receiver as she reached for her wallet.
Damn it!
The phone cord had been cut. Sydney had its vandals just like anywhere else. She whirled, expecting to see a police officer jogging up to her, but instead spied another dark-clad man cutting through the pedestrians. He drew a gun.
Holy shit! Gun!
The passersby dove behind a parked car, giving the man a clear shot at Anya.
Just how many of you are after me?
A bullet struck the side of the payphone. Anya raced out of the phone booth and off the sidewalk, over the curb and onto the street, where a bus was just pulling away. The driver was closing the door in panic, but she managed to squeeze on. The door slammed closed behind her.
A brass button.
Anya gaped at the bus driver.
We're being shot at. Just get this bus moving, for the love of God.
She found an Australian dollar, nicknamed a brass button, in her wallet. She held it up in front of the driver and dropped it in the fare box.
Here. Happy?
You hurt, miss.
I'm fine, really.
Anya threaded her way down the center of the bus to the back, sagging into an empty seat and avoiding the curious stares of the dozen passengers. An elderly woman peered over the back of her seat to stare at Anya.
Pig's ass, you're bleeding! And you're in your underwear!
It's a bikini top. I'm fine.
Pigs, you're fine.
Anya closed her eyes and pictured Oliver.
I'll wager I'm in better shape than my cameraman.
As the bus had moved farther from her hotel, the sirens had grown silent. Anya was relieved that they weren't following the bus. Touching her sore cheek, she refused to look up, sensing the other passengers staring at her. She needed more clothing and her cell phone, any phone, so she could call Doug and try Oliver again. She needed to call the police, too. She needed to think. Anya let the bus rock her, hoping it would relax her. But instead, she felt more anxious. In her mind's eye, she saw Oliver's empty room and the spot of blood. She saw the faces of the men who'd attacked her, their hard, cold eyes, and then the lifeless bodies of the ones she'd killed. The tall one, called Sute, loomed large in her memory. Something about him bothered her, beyond her killing him. She didn't regret what she'd done. She'd had no choice. Still, she felt sorry for the dead men's families. And she was sorry she had not been able to capture one and ask him questions. She focused on the sounds around her and tried to clear her mind. The spot of blood faded, and instead she called up the image of Hathor on the piece of pottery Wes Michaels had passed to her. Smooth and warm, she remembered the shard feeling, somehow comforting. A few moments later, the bus slowed and stopped at a traffic light. What had she done leaving a crime scene, she wondered. She respected the authorities, had certainly dealt with them in many foreign countries, and if she'd stayed in the hotel, she wouldn't have encountered the two thugs on the sidewalk. Seven in total, all dressed in black, all foreign, and all wanting to kill her. The light changed and the bus trundled on. Again, she saw the face of the tall one. They probably killed Oliver because of whatever he'd seen, and they'd dumped his body somewhere.
And they think I saw it, too. Saw what he did. But just what did we see?
She dismissed the etched image of the goddess Hathor and tried to replay the past several days in her mind, focusing on what Wes Michaels had uncovered at the dig. There was nothing extraordinarily valuable, she thought, although extraordinary in the fact there were Egyptian relics on Australian soil. Nothing on the scale of Nefertiti's resting place, she thought, or King Tut's tomb. Nothing worth killing over, certainly.
Missing something. Something important, obviously. What did I see?
One of the bus's rear wheels hit a pothole and bounced her harshly against the seat. Anya opened her eyes just as the bus found another pothole, this one even deeper. Her teeth clacked together, and she managed to bite both the inside of her cheek and her tongue.
Got a bingle over there. Yep, it's a big bingle, all right.
The elderly woman who had stared at Anya got up out of her seat and pressed her face to the window for a better look.
Someone's going to the hospital, I'll bet.
A bingle?
An accident.
A young woman with a streak of pink in a shock of otherwise jet-black hair had sidled back to sit across the aisle from Anya. She was dressed in tight green leather pants and a purple shirt that was a little too short for her long arms, and red tennis shoes without laces, everything clashing. She pointed out the window at the late model station wagon that had plowed into the back of something that looked like a Mini Cooper.
Probably some tourist not used to driving on the left. Both cars are cactus.
Anya guessed cactus meant dead. The bus slowed, no doubt so the driver could get a good look too. Steam was pouring out of the station wagon. The hood crumpled and the left front tire caved under, and the driver of what was left of the little car held his head in his hands. There was a man in black on the corner staring at the bus. One of the men who'd chased her? One of their associates? Or was it her imagination taking a vivid turn? Anya turned so she could get a better look at him. No, he didn't look anything like the others. Blonde hair and a pale complexion, listening to something on an iPod. Nothing to worry over, she told herself. She was about to sigh in relief, but froze. Running along the sidewalk and pushing his way through the people watching the bingle was a swarthy-looking man dressed in black. She made a move to rise, intending to jump off the bus and confront him, but the bus wheezed away into traffic, and she lost sight of him. The pink-haired girl looked at her with interest.
You're too, ain't ya?
Yes.
Anya gave a slight smile and nodded. The gesture hurt. Her face was sore from where the gun had struck her, and a headache was starting to crescendo behind her eyes. She wanted to get a look in the mirror to assess the damage, especially to check out her shoulder wound. Her skin felt tight and warm there. Again, she cursed herself for bolting instead of speaking with the police and getting a little medical attention.
Getting a fight. Car accident.
Some men chased me.
Oh, yeah, I saw.
She popped a stick of gum in her mouth and calmly grabbed the seat back when the bus lurched around a corner a little too sharply. Anya had no trouble balancing herself.
Guy on the sidewalk shooting at you. I saw him just before the bus left the stop. All diehard and lethal whipping-like. Wow, you know? None of my bizzo, really. But why was he after you? I mean, you look pretty spunk and all. Was he wanting to have a go at you? Did you pinch something of his?
I didn't steal anything, and I don't know why they were after me.
Yeah, you don't look like the pinching type. Where you from? You look familiar.
New York?
Huh, never been there.
Pink Streak cocked her head, looking at Anya more closely, then slapped her palm against her leg.
TV! That's it! I seen you on TV!
Anya inwardly groaned. She'd not expected the punk girl to have watched something like Chasing History's Monsters.
A model, I bet. A tall puppy, you. Got the body for it, you have. And...
Anya opened her mouth to reply, but the bus rattled and wheezed to a stop. It eased to the curb and the doors opened.
Darlinghurst.
Anya got up and hurried down the aisle. The pink-haired girl waved after her.
Aye! Watch yourself! And keep to Potts Point!
Potts Point? Anya had no idea what that was or where. However, within a heartbeat, she did know where she stood. King's Cross. Anya realized it the moment she stepped onto the sidewalk and looked down the street. She'd grabbed a stack of pamphlets the first morning she ate breakfast in the hotel restaurant, something to look at while she waited for her food. The first pamphlet she'd skimmed was about King's Cross. She recognized some of the buildings pictured in the advertisement. The waiter told her the cross had been painted by the Australian media as the drug and red light district of the entire continent, but that it had cleaned up its image in the past 2 decades. It certainly was colorful. Even on this sunny day, neon lights glowed bright and hung from practically every building. Many of the businesses on both sides of the tree-lined street were a mix of adult bookshops, dingy-looking nightclubs, seedy bars, burlesque shows, and strip clubs. Adult gifts, one neon sign advertised. Live nude dancers, another read.
Like anyone would want to see dead nude dancers.
She spied a sign hanging lopsidedly over a weathered wooden door that read, Backpackers Welcome. On a storefront window next to it, flyers were taped announcing AIDS testing, health clinics, and a place where intravenous drug users could inject themselves under supervision. Anya shivered. She wrapped her arms around herself and looked for a payphone. One more attempt to call Oliver and Doug. Then she'd make a call to the police and come up with a reason why she'd run from the hotel. The police had to know who she was, from the tag on her luggage or from checking with the hotel. Anya spotted a convenience store and decided she'd go there first, then make some calls. In the block running east, she saw that no cars were allowed on the street, that it was limited to pedestrian and bicycle traffic. A frumpy-looking woman on a 10-speed stopped and stared. Anya would not have been out of place, given the wild assortment of people and their dress in this neighborhood, but the blood spatters were raising eyebrows. No shirt, no shoes, no service, the sign on the convenience store said. Anya ignored it and went inside. The place was a riot of useful day-to-day items and a buffet of cheesy tourist trap bait. Clothes, toys, candy. A banner at the back said chemist, so she headed in that direction and picked up gauze, alcohol, first aid tape, and a pair of scissors. She also grabbed a long-sleeved, silky beige shirt with an aboriginal design of a kangaroo splayed across the front. She set the stuff on the counter and tried to avoid the clerk's concerned look.
Fell off my bike in the street. I'm okay.
The woman looked at her doubtfully, but took the money handed to her. Anya took her purchases and headed to the back of the shop where she'd seen a restroom sign. The restroom was the dirtiest she'd seen in some time. The mirror was chipped and filmy, and Anya was thankful for that, as it helped to mask her appearance. She ran water in the rusty sink and thoroughly cleaned her shoulder where the bullet had grazed it.
Thank God he wasn't a better shot.
The wound was superficial, but it had bled enough to make a good bit of her bikini top pink. After scrubbing the dirt off the little piece of soap she found, she washed the blood off her arm and tried to get some of it out of her top. She dried off with some paper towels and smoothed her hair behind her ears. She splashed her face and gingerly touched her scraped cheek. It would be bruising soon. She tossed the paper towels onto the top of the overflowing trash can and put on the new shirt. Feeling better than she had since breakfast, she remembered seeing a payphone on the far corner of the block. It was near the famous El Alamein Fountain, a huge, globe-like water display that she would have considered pretty were her circumstances different. She left the bathroom and headed to the door. Anya tried to muster a smile for the clerk, who was still staring at her. The woman didn't look convinced at all as Anya yanked open the shop door and stepped out onto the street. Anya hadn't taken more than a dozen steps when a man with a hand like a ham grabbed her arm and pulled her into a shadowed doorway. John looked as if he wasn't quite old enough to drive, but he was a second-year graduate student in anthropology with an emphasis in archaeology. His round baby face and massive curly red hair hid some of his years, as did the fact that he'd made no attempt to move out of his parents' house and didn't care that all his friends knew it. Didn't matter anyway, with him being finally out on an important student dig. He sat cross-legged on a small rug he'd brought with him, a futile effort to keep the dirt off his pants, and he stared at a slab of stone he'd just brushed off. The first image in the upper left corner was of a cane crooked to the right, with a tilted square sitting halfway up from its base. Next to it were four circles stacked on top of each other like a snowman without features, and a legless creature that looked like a cross between a walrus and a dog. There was also a setting sun, a cow-headed man holding an ankh, a three-legged owl, parallel wavy lines, stiff-looking birds, a narrow pyramid, and a heavily lashed eye. The symbols were at the same time crude and elegant, and he tentatively touched the walrus dog.
Amazing! Thousands of years old! And this is just glorious.
The images had been weathered by the salty sea air and the dirt that had sifted above them for centuries. Still, there wasn't a single figure that couldn't be made out. Translating them was another matter. Cindy, a classmate whose sun-leathered face made her look quite a bit older than her 24 years, leaned over John's back to get a better look at the slab, hands on his shoulders and breasts grazing the top of his head. Unlike John, she'd made no attempt to keep the dirt off her clothes, which had been eggshell white when she started the day's work.
Hi, John. No one at the uni could make much of that last piece you dug up. None of the profs could figure out any story from it, but they were using newer translation texts.
She pushed off John and came around to squat in front of him, the slab between them. Despite the cooling weather, she'd worn shorts. John stared at her knees.
Doc figured it out, though. The only prof who could. He showed me his notes this morning. They're on a clipboard over by the cooler if you want to take a look.
I want to finish here first.
John dropped his gaze to the slab. The wind gusted and Cindy shivered. John looked at her knees again and noted the goosebumps.
I'll tell you what his notes say, then. Doc used the old translation guides on the slabs. Says they talk about an expedition looking for yellow metal. Think about it. Gold.
John looked her in the face now. Cindy was pretty, definitely, with plenty of curves. but there were creases around her eyes and at the corner of her lips. Too much time spent suntanning, and the pale blonde color she chose to dye her hair was unflattering and brittle-looking.
Yeah, gold, I know. The Egyptians use gold on some of their sarcophagi.
So anyway, Doc says your slab goes on to say that while the Egyptians were exploring around here, their leader was bitten by a poisonous snake and died. Prof thinks maybe there's a tomb around here somewhere, and that maybe it's on this side of the ridge. Maybe somewhere down through the crevice.
So it'd be our find. The unis, I mean. Not Dr. Michaels and his team over yonder. It'd be a kick if the uni found a tomb while Dr. Michaels and his so-called professional team picked the wrong spot to dig.
She smiled, the invisible braces on her teeth showing.
Doc wants us to keep quiet about it. Not to traipse over the hill and breathe a word to Dr. Michaels. Not to...
I could write my thesis on it.
I don't care who gets credit for what, John, or if the uni makes headlines. I don't give a rat's ass about your thesis, don't you get it? Gold! If the Egyptians were looking for gold and found it, well, it's probably buried in the tomb.
Christ, Cindy, just when I thought you were taking archaeology seriously, your bleeding magpie complex kicks in.
Gold. Treasure. Maybe some pretty little pieces don't have to be catalogued. Know what I mean? Maybe I might just get compensated and then some for all the clothes and shoes I ruined on this blasted project. Besides, we both know I'm not going to get an A out of this. I'll be lucky if I pass. I figure I might as well get something.
Oh, for God's sake.
How did she ever make it this far at the university? There were 12 graduate students assigned to this dig. Next semester, it would be a different 12. A part of him hoped it would be next semester's batch that uncovered the tomb. He didn't want to deal with Cindy's sticky fingers. The girl shot him with what she obviously thought was a flirty look and sashayed off.
I should report her.
John returned his attention to the slab, then pulled a notebook out of his pocket and fluttered the pages to knock the dirt out. He thumbed through his scrawl about this particular site. Originally, it had been heavily overgrown with vegetation and rock. The soil line had been higher. It was considered a tertiary site, compared to the larger site Dr. Michaels' professional crew was digging just over the rise. There had been previous excavation attempts at the very spot where John sat, but nothing much had come of it, not even when a philanthropist had brought in expensive laser scanning equipment. That was why the university in Sydney had been given the go-ahead to send their graduate students to this place. There were some interesting pieces, but nothing spectacular was expected to be found. It was just a place to train would-be archaeologists. To John's knowledge, this was the first time the university had been involved in something considered a fringe project. Even some of the professors scoffed at the notion of Egyptians on Australian soil. But John knew it was more than likely Egyptians actually had come here, beyond the evidence that was directly in front of him. Australia appeared on a Greek map dated earlier than 200 years BC, and Sumerian and Mayan writings referenced a lost land in the Pacific. Then, more than 20 years ago, archaeologists in Fayum, Egypt, discovered remains of kangaroos. And 80 years ago, things looking suspiciously like boomerangs were found in Tutankhamun's tomb. So ancient peoples from far away, worlds away, knew about Australia. And in John's view, certainly had been here, even before the Aborigines.
Fringe nothing. This is all fair dinkum. And screw the gold. Hello, award-winning thesis and a free ride in some doctorate program. Indiana Jones, eat your ever-loving heart out.
Startled, John scrambled to his feet. Dr. Gaiji Hammam, or Doc, as his graduate students affectionately called him, was a small man, at little more than 5 feet, and slender. Most of the students dwarfed him. He was a tidy person, somehow staying clean despite sifting and digging alongside his charges. John admired him because Doc didn't ask the students to do anything he wouldn't do himself. He was always in a broad-brimmed hat to shield his face from the sun. He had several in his jeep and was wearing an olive-green one today with a tie that disappeared into his thick black beard.
Doc, sorry, I didn't hear you.
You know I detest those Indiana Jones films, John. Pure balderdash. Cindy said she told you about my translations.
Yeah?
Walk with me.
Sure.
Doc rubbed his hands together as they walked and pursed his lips. Their course took them past the students around the sifting table and beyond the tents where they passed the nights. They came to a rock cleft where a piece of split sandstone had formed a crevice. Spikes held a rope ladder that led down into it. The crevice couldn't be seen from a distance. Because of the sandstone and the shadows that extended from the ridge, John almost had to be on top of it to notice. John hoped he was being given permission to climb down. Doc was careful about the university's liability and only allowed students down there under careful supervision. There were more hieroglyphs down there. A lot more.
Tomorrow, you and I and Matthew will go down and take many more photographs, bring some things up. There's important work to do.
We could go down now.
Tomorrow, when we've a full day of it. I've got some lights coming in the morning that will make it much easier to see. I need the light to better translate.
John anxiously shifted back and forth on the balls of his feet.
I just knew you'd be able to translate that first tablet. And in the one I'm still cleaning, you'll read that one too.
These hieroglyphics are very ancient, from the early dynasties. Most Egyptologists would not be able to translate them, John. They're all schooled to read what's called Middle Egyptian. Very few, myself one of them, can read the formative styles.
Because these hieroglyphics look a little like Phoenician and Sumerian.
And that's one of the reasons not everyone thinks these hieroglyphics are Egyptian.
So much to fool them.
Fools indeed.
Think I'm gonna pass this class, Doc?
John cringed, realizing he shouldn't be asking something like this so soon in the session. Doc crossed his arms and just stared at John.
Presumptuous of me, huh? Sorry.
You'll pass this class. We both know you're my best student.
John's eyes gleamed, and he allowed himself a small smile. Doc reached into the deep pocket of his jacket. He retrieved a satellite phone and thumbed a button.
If you'll excuse me, John.
Doc continued walking.
I'm gonna ace this.
John happily headed back to clean his slab. Doc waited until he was well out of earshot of any of the students, then held the phone to his ear.
This had better be important to bother me here while I am with the students. Anya Creed? The American? You have her, yes?
She escaped us, but we killed her cameraman. He put up a little fight. No one will find this body.
Doc scowled.
Go on.
We have his cameras and his computer. They're on the way to your office now. I put them in a packing crate, just as you told me, labeled it so anyone looking will think it's filled with books.
What else?
The rest of the television people. They left before we got to the hotel. Likely they are of no consequence. It was the cameraman and Anya Creed. They're the only ones who saw.
And you let her get away?
Yes, she got away, sir, master. She had a sword. She killed Zuka and Sute. And
where is Anya Creed now?
Master, she got on a bus. I could not read the words. I do not know its destination. The police came to the hotel, and we had to leave. We could not take the bodies with us. Zuka and Sute and...
Doc held the phone away from him and stared at it, the shadow cast by the big brim of his hat obscuring the buttons. Finally, he brought it back to his ear.
I suggest you find her, or you may also be among the casualties.
He replaced the phone in his pocket, stood quietly, and stared at the rise that separated the two digs. After several minutes, he turned and retraced his steps. He stopped at the slab John still busily and carefully cleaned. John didn't look up. He fixed his gaze on Doc's shoes.
You can translate this, right?
Of course. Let me read it to you.